morning, everyone. Meeting called to order November 4th, 2009 at 9:05. Before proceeding with any business, I believe Mr. Smith has a statement to make.
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A public notice of this meeting containing all items on the proposed agenda has been filed in the office of the Secretary of State as required by Chapter 551 Government Code, referred to as the Open Meetings Act. I'd like to impact the noting of the direction. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. We'll begin with the Regulations Committee. Commissioner Freakin will be unable to join us at this time, so I will call this committee. Okay. First order of business is the approval of the previous committee meeting minutes, which have already been distributed. Is there a motion for approval?
Second.
Okay. Commissioner Hickson, second. Commissioner Falcone. Make sure I get everyone. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Hearing none, motion carries. Committee item number one, update on TPWD progress in implementing the TPWD Land and Water Resources Conservation and Recreation Plan. And by the way, is this the last one? Are they beginning to go?
Well, I think that if you approve the plan is presented today and tomorrow, then we will probably restructure these updates more consistent with that plan, specific deliverables that the commission was looking to us on staff. So look forward to working with you on that change form. I'll just wing it from here if that's okay.
No, that's okay. All right. So you're going to be it's old or new?
We'll do the old one today. I know. A couple of things I want to make sure the commission is aware of. Obviously, for most Texans, deer season, as they know it, opens on Saturday. So we're very, very excited about that right fall. Also, just wanted to let you know we had some really extraordinary youth hunts on a number of the WMAs over the weekend. I think what was particularly heartening about that is, you know, we suffered from a lot of shortage on fresh water coming down to a lot of our coastal WMAs. We were concerned about that, but it was nice to get the reports that the Mercury area is back up in action and actually was last year. We just had pretty good success out there. So we had visited all the coastal WMAs. We do have some WMAs that have been flooded out, Richard Creek and Big Lake Bottom and others that have just had too much water, so we've had to cancel a number of hunts there. But we're pushing hard to get kids into the other. That's a pretty good segue for earlier this week, Governor Perry signed a proclamation declaring November Hunter Appreciation Month. And so I think that's very fitting in our state that we recognize this month on behalf of our sportsmen who play such an important role in helping perpetuate that heritage and pass it on to future generations. So idea was born out of a discussion with the Texas Trophy Hunters who put that forward. So delighted to see that come to fruition. Also, in keeping with that, I think all of you know we have been very active in pushing the archery in schools programs in a number of school districts throughout the state, a particular focus in Houston. Really a phenomenally successful program to get kids participating in the shooting sports. We're now going to be exploring a partnership to hopefully set up some formal archery parks where kids can go outside of school to practice their use of bow and arrows. And so that's a kind of park that's been set up in other states. We're looking to have those in a kind of meaningful way in the state. We're looking forward to developing those. And thinking about Houston is kind of the pilot project here. Last thing I'll mention. Some of you may not be aware of the role that our ambulance play in enforcing environmental crimes. And so we have a cooperative agreement with the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality. And so when there are impacts, for instance, to our waters from illegal dumping and so forth, that impact our fish and wildlife, law enforcement teams play a very important role in helping to ensure the companies comply with those. Major case that we just resolved down in Corpus for illegal dumping of oil down in the Gulf of Mexico, and our law enforcement team did a super job there on that prosecution and ultimately secured a $1 million fine against the responsible company. So we think that's an important deterrent to make sure that the companies are adhering to these laws, and our LA team does a really good job on that, and it's a part of our business that we don't often talk about. So I wanted to share that update with you. Mr. Chairman, I think that's my my report for this morning. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Committee item number two, listing of certain mussel species as state threatened. Recommended adoption of proposed changes. Dr. Wendy Gordon, please.
Good morning, Chairman, committee members. I'm Dr. Wendy Gordon. I'm the program leader for non-invasive species program evaluation. I have an item here about adding to the state threatened list 15 species of mussels. I believe some of these slides will be familiar to you from the last committee meeting. So we have proposed the listing of these 15 species of freshwater mussel to be added to the state threatened list. And as a review or reminder, the state threatened list is determined by Chapter 67. Threatened species are those likely to become endangered in the future. And under the Administrative Procedure Act, 30-day notice is required prior to adoption by the Commission. And again, here is a brief depiction of where these species are found. And so six of them are located in the East Texas area, so the East Texas portion. And another five of them are essentially central Texas species. And then four of them are found in the Rio Grande Range area. So the proposed amendments again would add 15 species to the state threatened list. We went to the Texas Register. We received 25 comments in favor of the proposed amendment and one comment in opposition. And that comment addressed the issue of allowing personal collection. However, I'll point out that most of these species do not grow large enough to be collected under our regulations should they be found. And also, of course, they're extremely rare, so it might be that somebody comes to cross or come in contact with one of these. So our recommendation is for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Commission to adopt amendments to 31 TAC 65.975 concerning threatened mussels, and additionally, Chapter 57.157 concerning mussels and clams, with changes as necessary to the proposed text as published in the October 2nd, 2009 issue of the Texas Register. Any questions?
Any questions? Okay. Let's see. There is no discussion. I will place this item on Thursday's, tomorrow's Commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Thank you, Dr. Gordon. All right, any questions? Straightforward. Committee item number three, 2010-2011 statewide hunting and fishing proclamation preview. Mr. Clayton Wolf, please make your presentation.
Mr. Chairman and Commissioners, my name is Clayton Wolf. I'm the director of the Big Game Program. And this morning I'm going to present to you the Wildlife Division proposal. This is basically a preview of what we hope to come back with in January with requesting permission to publish the Texas Register. So this is our November briefing just to give you, the commissioner, some ideas of what we're thinking and also take some feedback so we can formalize our proposals in January. Also, I think everyone here is going to be delighted to know that my presentation has three slides in it as compared to last year. This will be very brief. Wildlife Division has one proposal concerning mule deer. The slide before you shows the current mule deer seasons in Texas. We have three different strategies for mule deer harvest. And as you see on the screen before you, up in the panhandle, the season is 16 days long, beginning Saturday before Thanksgiving. The western and southwestern panhandle is a 9-day season, starts at the same time. And then the last Saturday in November, the season runs for 16 days, and that's down in the Trans-Pecos. What we propose, if you look up there in the northeast portion of the panhandle, you'll see one county there that does not have an open season for mule deer. That's Wheeler County. If I toggle forward,
We would propose to have a 16-day season in Wheeler County. And then I'll toggle back again. If you look down there in the green counties there on the south end, Dawson County, the county that we color in, is also the other county that we would propose to have a 9-day season. And with that, I'll be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Yes, sir. And are the game counts in Wheeler County the reason to include?
No. 2-3 years ago, we got a request to open mule deer season in some counties that really are very low deer population, mule deer populations. And if you look at an aerial photo of some of that, a lot of it's agricultural land, a little bit of range land, but there are some small populations of mule deer. And we went forward with a proposal under the premise that buck-only harvest would not impact any population recruitment or expansion. That might impact the age structure since the population had been harvested. But the reality is because these are very fragmented and because our mule deer lines are based on compartments, not counties, it's probably highly unlikely that we fly over that whole chunk of land in Wheeler County. But we do have data that mule deer exist and they fall into those compartments of low numbers. And so we were proposing a strategy that's a very conservative harvest strategy.
What was the public comment on this?
We haven't received any yet. We'll be going forward in January if y'all give us permission to do that. And we'll be taking public comment during that time frame.
Okay. So this is for what season you provided?
This would be for next year.
Next year. Okay. So you can.
That's correct.
Okay, all of this, though, of course, for this season. Is that correct?
I'll show you right. This is what's going to happen starting this month.
Yeah. Okay.
Current mule deer season, and then this would be for the 2010-11 season. Okay. What we were talking about.
So I think what we're just looking for, Commissioner, just some direction. Should we go ahead and proceed with scoping this further and come back in January with a hard and fast proposal?
I think it simplifies the process.
What we've asked staff just last round to look at this and try to look at any county where we think we might propose mule deer seasons, and then we would let it rest for several years, kind of following the same strategy we were using with our whitetail deer regulations. So we're hoping that we have cast the net far and wide and picked up every county in this proposal, and then we would probably let that with your permission right for several years before, so we're not constantly changing our regulations.
Straightforward.
Thank you.
Mr. Ken Krasowski making a presentation also.
Morning, Commissioners. My name is Ken Krasowski with the Inland Fisheries Division. And as Clayton mentioned, this is our opportunity to give you some idea of what we're considering for a coming regulatory cycle. Also, similar to wildlife, after last year doing alligator, yarn, and previous year doing bull fishing for catfish, we're having a, hopefully we'll have a little quieter year. We really just have one minor proposal we're considering, and it concerns some in language in our proclamation that governs the possession of fish. We want to clarify that language in the statewide hunting and fishing proclamation, and basically want to ensure those descriptions on bag and possession limits and length limits can be enforced and easily understood. We have some language that governs how bag and length limits are implemented out on the water, and also when you get off the water before you reach your final destination, and we want to make sure for the game wards they can enforce those, and also when we set those special regulations on the water that they'll achieve the desired results on the populations. That's all I have.
Pretty straightforward. So are we going to see these in the future? Or
yes,
just
we'll have in January if we discuss this with law enforcement and coastal fisheries, and we think we have some language there, and if that's, that works for pretty well, we'll bring that over to January.
Any questions? You can.
I'd like to point out that several of the coastal communities have fish cleaning. Or bait stands will clean your fish. I guess under the current proposal, if I take my fish to a bait stand for cleaning, I can't put it back in my boat and try to transport it back to my house. Are you going to look at any of that and change the regulations?
the idea that right now, if I drop off fish and put a plate to clean the fish for pay, they can go back into the boat you brought on, transport back to your house or your trailer to move it across. It looks like this to me, that may be something I want to look at, modify a little bit. Does that come up or that been brought up?
Well, the idea of what final destination and everything is always something we're always looking at to make sure anglers understand it. Robert Goodrich, you could address that.
Robert. The question, as I understand it, would be about transporting the fish after they've been cleaned.
Correct.
And one of the reasons we have that in place is so that, you know, fish don't lose their identity and length and everything else as far as measurements and the bag. And if you had that situation where fish were cleaned and then transported by boat, it would kind of open up the door to that not being able to identify who's done what, so that we are looking at that part of it as well.
There's
quite a few reasons behind that regulation, so
I understand.
So that's an overview of why we have it, so that we can identify the species and the length and the bag. If it's transferred, it's, you know, delayed or processed, then that's the identity is lost.
Some of those rules aren't that, those general rules in that section we're looking at, and we'll look at those and give you an opportunity to look at those and make sure that they're understandable and get enforceable by the words of the special regulation.
Robert Edwards.
Yeah,
they try to get with Bert Edwards.
Okay,
great. Thank you, guys. Appreciate it. Thanks again. Mr. Robin Riker, please.
Good morning, Chairman, Commissioners. Based on the past two presentations, I may not win the simplest award this time around. But I am here to present the 2010-2011 coastal fisheries scoping items. The first one that I'm going to present to you is actually an item that we're proposing not to scope, but because we've had so much discussion regarding this issue, I at least wanted to mention it to you and give you some of our rationale for why we wouldn't want to scope this at this time. And that's the issue of maintaining or becoming consistent with federal regulations regarding red snapper. We had anticipated that the current stock assessment, a new stock assessment, would have been presented to the Gulf of Mexico Fishery Management Council 2 weeks ago in Corpus Christi, Texas. As it turns out, that did not get finished in time and has not been presented to us. It hasn't even undergone all the scientific review that it will undergo before it reaches the council. And at this point, it won't reach the council until February 2010, at least that's the anticipated time frame. And of course, that would be after the time frame that we would propose actions to y'all in January. So with that kind of timetable in mind, we would expect that the Gulf Council will take actions that would start to impact the fishery, not necessarily in seasonally, because that can be done by the regional administrator and probably will change next summer. But as far as bag limits or any other differential seasons between eastern and western Gulf, more complicated kinds of things, we wouldn't anticipate that to occur until 2011 and maybe even 2012, given the length of that process. So what we would propose at this point is to not go to scoping with this at this time and consider this for scoping next fall.
Can I just stop you right there?
Yes.
So does that just leave everything status quo, essentially?
For us, it would leave us at status quo, which is four fish in a year-round season.
Yes.
And of course, the federal season, recreationally right now, is two fish and runs. This year it ran from June 1st to August 14th, 75 days. Given the predicted overage in the recreational season, and assuming status quo as far as total allowable catch for the recreationals, and somehow that's not changed, we would expect that season to probably reduce itself fairly dramatically as we move forward.
Reduce itself?
Yes, sir.
for recreation, and where we're on commercial and how that was.
The commercial management now is under an individual fishing quota where each individual receives a share of the total catch that the commercial side is allowed. They can fish that 365 days a year, but when their quota is met, they're basically off the water. When that individual meets his share of that total, whatever that may be, it may be 10,000 pounds, and that person catches his 10,000 pounds, and he no longer can fish for red snapper unless he can obtain or get caught from something else.
That will stay the same, essentially, within our waters, but if the water is fed, then what can they do between now and whatever?
What can happen between now and the next season is they can look at the how quickly or the overage of the overall quota, and they can reduce the recreational season to try to stay within that quota limit. So we were at 75 days. It's predicted that quota is going to overrun by about 70%, so I would expect that our days are going to be reduced somewhere in the neighborhood of 40% or so in federal waters. From the commercial side, the quota program is running now. I will say that recently, last week, Governor Perry, as well as the other governors in the Gulf states, did send a note or send a letter to Assistant Secretary Lukashenko, and is requesting that these multi-use fisheries where IFQs or catch limits have been put in place, that we kind of take a closer look at those and that we review those closer, because with this multi-use fishery, it doesn't seem to be, without trading of shares between recreational and commercial allocations and allowing for that shifting of shares, that combined with the fact that we've had reductions in total allowable catches after these systems have went into place, it really calls in some hardship on these recreational fisheries. And the whole idea of that recreational fishery, as we well know here, is to sell those licenses, to sell bait, tackle, and tourism as well. And so the governors have asked that the National Marine Fisheries Service kind of slow down on catch shares and really take a look at how these are working in these multi-use fisheries.
Any other questions?
Yes,
sir. In February 2010, stock assessment, you think you'll get it then? I mean, I know you did the feds, but what's your sense of it, I guess?
We certainly believe we will. We think they're getting the analysis finished up. They, you know, like I said, they anticipated October. They didn't get it finished by then. We believe that they will finish up that analysis and go for some of the scientific review that it's supposed to undergo in December, and will be presented to the council in February, is what we believe.
Okay, if it's presented to council in February, between then and the April meeting, the April reserve.
It's either March or April.
I can't remember. When's our meeting?
Carol.
It's the last day of March, first day of April.
Okay. Will you have enough time to at least study that assessment at some level to come back and bring a presentation to this commission?
We can certainly bring you a presentation of where it stands. Now, obviously, given the timing of regulation changes and so forth, we wouldn't necessarily be able to get a proposal in the register and considering the proposal. But we can brief you on where what the red snapper stock assessment, what kind of the final results are.
Yeah, I think it's time again. I was trying to double take it for a while. I think it's time we need a full with the commission. It seems like it's going to come after this assessment. What do you think?
Yes, I think we'll have a lot more information to feed the system, if you will, when we get this assessment.
Okay.
And Chairman, Robin and our team have been having conversations with various stakeholders about this issue. And a lot of questions,
a lot of issues.
Okay.
Go ahead, Robin. Thank you on that one. Go ahead.
Next, we will move into items that we actually are proposing to scope for regulation purposes at this point in time. And the first one deals with snook. And in Texas, our population of snook is both made up of common snook and fat snook. They're pretty difficult to identify if you're not a biologist in some respects, and so we just lump those together for the fishermen. When we look at our past management history there, you can see that 1987 was our first rule regarding snook. We put a minimum size limit of 18 inches and a maximum size limit of 30 inches and set the bag and possession limit at 5 and 10 respectively. 1990, we followed that up and we basically shrunk those that size limit or that size class where we allow take to 20 to 28 inches and went to a 3 fish bag and 6 possession.
1996, we further increased that minimum size limit to 24 inches and left the 28-inch upper end size range and reduced the bag limit from 1 to 2 fish. What we've seen with our current population trends, and of course, just for your edification, this is really a lower Laguna Madre phenomenon regarding common smolt. We do see fat smolt further up the coast, but mostly we're at kind of the northernmost range of Mexico, Texas, common smolt population here. And so most of our catches, greater than 80% of those, come from the lower Laguna Madre. But you can see the population trends are certainly going upward since we passed those regulations and really trending upward rather rapidly. What we're proposing that we scope here is a reduction in the minimum size limit, change that minimum size limit from 24 to 22 inches. What this would basically do is allow for some take of fat smolt. Fat smolt maximum maturity size is somewhere around 23 inches or so. So we believe that this will allow for some of those larger fat smolt to be taken into the bag with really very minimal impacts to common smolt. We have a couple of additional scoping items, and the first one that I would like to present to you is just a strengthening of our commercial reporting requirements. Within the context of commercial reporting, we basically have the authority to request that people report any of their landings or catches in some form or fashion. And we've been doing this, and we've been reaching out to people. Specifically, we've seen an increase of sale from the boat directly to the restaurant or sale from the boat directly to individuals. And while we think we have had the authority to do this, we want to be really expressed with that requirement. So we would like to go into our proclamation and strengthen this area so that everyone knows out there who's making that exchange knows who's supposed to report and when they're supposed to report. So we would propose looking at that as a scope item. And then the second part of this is separating our commercial and recreational statewide proclamations. And as you know, they're all fairly a large volume of material you have to go through. They're both recreational and commercial in nature right now. What we hope to do is separate those two proclamations. That provides us some benefits, both just in size and volume, and people actually wading through those materials and knowing where to find certain things. The other thing that it does for us in regards to our Administrative Procedures Act is create some simplification of some of the analysis we have to do regarding economic impacts to recreational and commercial businesses. We don't have to lump those when we go forward with those rulemaking. So that's another item that we would propose scoping as we move through this process. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions regarding any of those seven items.
Yes, sir.
Is that a draft?
Yeah.
This particular graph comes from our gillnet samples, and they are randomized samples, so we go to different spots. But we do them at the same time of the year each year in all bay systems. And so that's really what we look to. We call that fishery-independent data, which basically takes my ability or your ability to catch those fish out of the equation. And so we basically use that as our population trend analysis. It tells us whether the population is going up or down. Yes, sir.
70,
and most of those, 83% of those or so, were caught in the lower Laguna Madre. Now, that's a fairly small number. That is a small abundance in regards to any fish that we would normally see in hot, like spotted sea trout, as compared to spotted sea trout, red drumming, which you would catch a lot of in each one of those sets, where for snook, we see less than one fish per set or gillnet. So it is a small number, but again, we're at the upper end of that Texas-Mexico range. But our population has been increasing, and we believe the one big bag limit is still allowed to keep increasing. Yes.
Any other questions for Rob? Rob, is that yours? You're done.
That's my.
It wasn't that difficult. Okay, thank you for your presentations. No further action required. Committee item number 4, deer breeder rule, deer importation. Recommended adoption of proposed changes. Kevin Schwach, please. Kevin.
Morning, Mr. Chairman, Commissioner.
record. My name is Kevin Foss. I'm the big game program specialist. This morning I'm going to bring an item concerning the current prohibition on the importation of white-tailed deer and mule deer into Texas on the continuing concerns of, about transmissible diseases. Under Parks and Wildlife Code, the Commission is authorized to regulate the status of deer held in captivity under the deer breeder's permit and the procedures and requirements for the purchase, transfer, sale, or shipment of breeder deer. Current rules do not allow for the importation of deer or white-tailed deer or mule deer into Texas. In March of 2009, the United States Department of Agriculture published a proposed rule that would create a single federal regulatory standard to replace the various state regulations that were proposed in response to CWD. Although the current breeder rule was promulgated in 2005 in response to concerns over CWD, in the process of evaluating the proposed USDA rule, we recognize that our current entry prohibition serves not only as a comprehensive disease management strategy, and we wanted to clarify on the record that our current entry prohibition was intended to mitigate numerous disease threats for our next deer herd. Now, this proposal, if adopted, will demonstrate to others that many disease risk factors exist for deer and other wildlife in addition to chronic wasting disease. Staff has been concerned about various epidemiological threats such as exotic silkworm, episodic hemorrhagic disease, adenovirus, and malignant catarrhal fever, all of which are viruses that can affect deer or can be transmitted to deer from deer to wildlife and other livestock. Staff therefore recommends the continued closure of the state to the importation of white-tailed deer and mule deer. We are proposing this rule, this amendment, because we believe the rationale for the basis of this rule should not be narrowly focused on chronic wasting disease, but serve as a more comprehensive analysis of numerous of these threats. The White-tailed Deer Advisory Committee was briefed on this proposal, and they support the continued border closure. And we've had 16 public comments. We've had one addition this morning. There are 13 in support of the proposal, and three that are in opposition of the comments on the opposition. One didn't give any specific comments to the opposition. Another stated that they'd like to see the importation of the borders open, but did add that there should be some quarantine with possible testing for deer that were imported. And a third person seemed to be somewhat confused as to what the proposal was intended to address. Felt that it by Trump to the DMV rules, in which case it was with that, I'll conclude my presentation. I'll be happy to answer questions.
Are we effectively just keeping the regulation as is, but just broadening the definition of the reason for that?
Yes, we're repealing the rule that we have and then we're imposing and putting a new rule back in place that would be more broad and more comprehensive to the strategy.
Do elk fall within this prohibition?
No, sir. Elk fall under the rules of text down low.
Okay. Any other questions? Let me see. Let me see. If there are no further questions, discussion, I'll place this item on Thursday's submission meeting agenda for public comment and action.
Thank you.
Committee number five, item number five, if you can propose a new state falconry regulation, draft or proclamation, Commissioner first rule to text register and that reading, please.
Good morning, Chairman and Commissioners. My name is Matt Reed. I'm a state board of wildlife biologist for South Texas District. And today I'll talk to you about the Raptor Proclamation and proposed new falconry regulations. As has been stated before, to simplify falconry permitting, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has recently revised federal falconry rules, and they're getting out of the permitting process. In order to get under these new federal falconry rules, state programs have to certify under the rules. Thus, Texas are currently under the review for certification for January 2010. However, our current regulations must be revised in the certification process. The department has formed a committee to revise state regulations. The committee is composed of 9 members, 6 employees of the department, and 4 actually doctors, to go through regulations and to look at the federal regulations and, you know, compared to our state regulations. The revised fire regulations, the framework of what they'll be, will be as shown here. Permit, the federal permit requirements will be removed. We'll establish general provisions, stipulate permit application requirements, describe permit privileges and restrictions, describe facility standards for housing raptors. They'll create trapping and hunting seasons for trapping of raptors and hunting of game, and establish rules for marking, banding, and using telemetry on raptors. Also create a review panel to allow for review of permit decisions in case of denial or refusal to give a permit to a previous permitting. And in general, this is what we're working on right now. We hope to get permission to publish this in the next stretch.
Do the proposed revised regulations include the fee for the permit?
Yes. We will actually stay the same as the state has
previously. Will we have the ability to adjust the upward cost of managing the program?
With the new criteria, if I'm hunting, for instance, in the Texas Panhandle and following the state regulation for Texas across the border to Mexico, is there going to be some symmetry of regulation working with other states to try to make it where it's not prohibitive for people that live near a state border to go back and forth?
Federal property rules have regulations in place, and all states will have to fall under those federal property rules. So there will be a blanket. Federal property rules will still be there. They're just getting out of the permitting process. So you will be able to move between states, but just like being a normal hunter, you'll have to have your state power on permit as well as your hunting license for the other state.
But more than likely, the state where will not necessarily become more restrictive. I'm just trying to think of an instance where if you're able to hunt a certain species, you know, in Texas, and then across the border to New Mexico, and that species in that state is no longer hunted or something.
There is a possibility of that with all states being able to kind of go within that framework, and they can be more restrictive and protect more units in the federal regulation. There is that possibility. Plus, other states could require, say, if a falcon wanted to go to New Mexico, they may require that I get a New Mexico falcon permit before the fleet is expanded out there. And they're able to require that. But under these the falcon regulations within Fed, they're pretty open, and most states will come online, and they're not the only USD is what they may have to require you to, you know, apply for a temporary falcon permit at that individual stage.
No matter, are we going to try to coordinate or get a visit with the other states, at least surrounding us, New Mexico, Oklahoma?
I believe we're well ahead of them, to be honest. I haven't talked with the other states. I don't think any of us have as well. We can look into that stuff.
If you don't mind, please just try to coordinate. So, former fact.
I actually got a call from Colorado, some doctors in Colorado asking the process that we went through. This wasn't from the state agency. The doctors there are starting to work with the state agency, but they're asking the process that Texas has gone through to move forward with these regulations. So other states are just starting to come online. They're taking a little bit longer than we are. But I'll
maybe you can do some coordination or something that way, so that every state has such different regulations. People can't move back and forth fairly easily.
Yeah.
Any other questions or comments?
Yes, just a kudos for the state and the department having talked about this. This is the first year that you were one of the first years that the falconers could put in to be able to take wild peregrine. And it's a national program, but I have been told by people who are very much in the know that Texas has done a much better job of administering that program than any of the other states.
We're definitely leading in that respect. I actually went down with the operators as well as the research work on the software. I was able to see how it was done, and it went very well. very soon. Yeah, I'll be very happy.
Do they take a while for to get their domesticated?
Yeah, they're likely to start.
Under the regulations, they're always wild bird. They'll always be considered wild bird. They cannot be sold or parted with, anything like that, but they can
hunt with them.
Yeah,
they keep them in captivity. Any other questions or comments? Great, Matt, thank you. No further discussion, I will authorize staff to post this item in the Texas Register to require public comment period. Sir, committee item number six, harmful or potentially harmful fish, shellfish, and aquatic plants, special provision, water spinach regulations, recommended adoption of proposed changes. Dr. Gary Saul, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, Commissioners. My name is Gary Saul. I'm Deputy Director of the Fisheries. It's a privilege for me today to represent the team that was assembled to address the commission charge we received in August after being in Fort Worth. Carter and Ross assembled a team that included members from the Legal Division, Law Enforcement Division, Executive Office, and Inland Fisheries. The team met several times to develop tasks, assign tasks, and then gather the information that ultimately came to you in the white paper there on October 1st. So what I would like to do is to be able to review with you very quickly what we did and the findings. And that was to develop the current status in Texas water spinach. What we did was we conducted informal visits to markets and restaurants to look for the commercial movement of water spinach in Texas. We initiated directed vegetation surveys in four metro areas, Dallas, Fort Worth, Austin, and San Antonio, and Houston, in a manner to focus on those areas where we might expect to find water spinach in the wild if it were to be established. We also evaluated 10 years of routine vegetation surveys that Inland Fisheries does as a matter of course in our business of fisheries management. We went back and reviewed the scientific literature, and we reviewed regulations from other states. So I'd like to take these in order, if I could, and we'll start with the market survey. Law enforcement game wardens visited 56 different markets. They were wholesale, retail, food markets, and restaurants in those four metro areas. They were informal visits. They went in and they asked basically four questions. How much water spinach do you purchase in a month's time? Do you consider it a year-round product or is it a seasonal product? Where do you get it from? Is it coming from in-state or is it coming from out-of-state? And if you are finding it in-state, where are you purchasing it? The results of that, and this is the table that was in the white paper that you received, in 55 of the 56 visits that law enforcement did, we found water spinach. Only one restaurant in Austin did not have water spinach when approached. The amount that was purchased varied widely, from just a few pounds at restaurants to one site in the Dallas-Fort Worth area that moved approximately 18,000 pounds per month. Wholesale costs ranged from 50 cents to $2, and we were told that the retail cost was about double the wholesale cost. When asked about where the water spinach was obtained, overwhelmingly the responses were from the Houston, Bushnell, and Aaron Bay. Although other areas were identified, in Dallas, Fort Worth, that we were told that they were receiving it from a local provider. And in San Antonio, we were told that someone in Kerrville was providing the water spinach.
Is that grown in those areas or a broker bring in?
We didn't really go any further in our questioning as we went through there. Yes, sir. So it would be something that could be followed up on in the future. We also did Oh, excuse me, I'm sorry. Then the other question that was asked was, is it year-round or is it seasonal fly? And we were told, the majority of the people told us that they saw it in their market, mostly from the months of March through October, although several other markets told us that they could get it year-round. We also did directed vegetation surveys, and this was developed using demographic data in these four metro areas where we did the law enforcement surveys. Those four areas were selected using a scientific process and demographic data to focus our sampling frame in an area where we might expect to see water spinach in the wild if it were to be established there. The sampling frame was a circle five miles in diameter, approximately 23 square miles in the area. And our staff then went to every water feature within this circle and looked to see whether or not they could find water spinach. I'd like to throw up two examples for you. They were presented in the document that you received. We're going to look at Dallas-Fort Worth first. And I'd like you to look at the circle that's on the lower right, Richardson Garland. Two things to note here. One is that the law enforcement sites are designated as a blue triangle. The inland fishery sites are designated as green squares. So we drove to every place that we could find water or ditches or water courses, and our staff would get out, and if they could do this on public land, they would go out and they would walk a distance of approximately 100 meters on either side looking for water spinning. So we did that throughout this area, and you can see that the overlap between law enforcement's visits to markets and restaurants and inland fisheries sampling was relatively good here. I'd like to take you to Houston. And again, we're going to focus on one area. In the Houston area, I'd like you to look at the lower ellipse. And this is an area that is much greater than 5 miles in diameter, but our staff there went to two areas that they felt as though would be prime spots to find water spinach if they could find it. And I'm going to focus on the Rocheron area. This is the area that we do know there is commercial production and has been produced there for a number of years. What I would like you to do, if you can see the green area that is outlined there for Rocheron, I'm now going to take you in a little bit closer. What is now outlined on your screen in yellow is the same track that our staff drove in this area. To the right of the picture, or on the upper right of the picture, is Chocolate Bayou. It goes down to Chocolate Bay, which then goes into West Bay and the Galveston Bay system. Our staff went over to Chocolate Bayou and looked along that area. In 2003, our staff did an intensive survey all along Chocolate Bayou and in this Rocheron area. If you will look
at there, in 2003, what was the reason you were doing the intensive survey?
In 2003 is one of the first times that we actually had become aware of the activity with water spinach.
Okay.
And we were trying to learn more about it at that time.
So you had the data then as you put this white paper together from 2003?
Yes, sir. And then this is a collection that occurred just this past month, or in September. So I'd like to call your attention to the upper left portion of this sample area here. I'm going to zoom in on that. And this is a neighborhood there in the Rocheron area. And what you can see in there are a lot of buildings. I want you to look one more time down to the very bottom left of this picture. And I'm going to zoom in one more time. And this is a part of Amy Lane in this neighborhood. And in this picture, there are over or approximately 50 greenhouses. Okay? It's a relatively small area, approximately 50 greenhouses. So I just want you to get an idea of the intensity with which that commercial growth can happen there. Besides,
what do you think the greenhouses are primarily growing water spinach?
We know that water spinach is growing in the greenhouses. We do not know that they are all growing water spinach. That's it. Besides these directed surveys, we also conduct routine vegetation surveys. Our staff are out on the water doing our fisheries management jobs, and we survey public waters for structural and habitat aspects of every reservoir, extremely important for fisheries management. So what we do is we go out and we characterize and quantify the habitat. We identify the native species and the endemic species. And that's an extremely important piece for us as we go forward. And on those lakes where we have identified noxious species that have become issues, we survey those lakes annually to monitor how those species are growing on those lakes. So over the past 10 years, from 1999 to 2009, we've surveyed 136 water bodies. And it's a total number of surveys, over 600. During this time period, we never have found water spinach, and we're looking throughout the state. Our staff, when they collect these data, if they come across a species that they don't know, an aquatic species they don't know, they bring it back in and have it identified by somebody who does. So in these surveys, we never saw any water spinach. In the directed surveys that we did in each of the four metro areas, we did not find any water spinach. The water spinach regulations among the states they're different. There are four states that prohibit water spinach completely. Those four states have taken the federal rules and adopted those federal rules for prohibition. In speaking to people there, we know of no occurrences of water spinach in that state. There are six states that regulate water spinach. They're listed in yellow, or they're colored in yellow there for you. And then there are a number of states in green that do not regulate water spinach. Of note, I think, is that California, in the last survey that we had done in California, it was a regulated species. California now has deregulated water spinach and is considered an agricultural crop and it's permitted.
When did they do that?
I don't know exactly when that was done, but we contacted everybody on the fish and game side and the folks with their agricultural department, and that is their approach now. So, in summary, what we found is that water spinach is readily available in markets, wholesale, retail, and in restaurants. We have not found it in the wild in the directed surveys that we did in the areas where we might expect it to escape, nor have we found it in the routine surveys that we conduct as regular business in fisheries management. Literature tells us that there's a low probability of survival in the wild. We realize that we cannot say in an unqualified way that it will not survive, but we do know that with the information that we have gathered at this point, we have not seen it in the wild. We are also aware that water spinach can be successfully treated if found with herbicides. We also know that it has been cultured in Texas for more than 20 years and that we have not seen it at this point become an environmental problem. The commission also asked us to look at what the regulatory options could be for water spinach. And what I would like to present to you is, starting with the most restrictive and going towards the least restrictive, what those options might be. The most restrictive option would be that the commission could propose new rules to to prohibit the possession of water suspension tanks. The next most restrictive would be to consider the proposed rules that have been published in the Texas Register in July that were presented to you in August. The next least restrictive, I guess I'm going that way, would be to continue the current regulations. The commission also could propose new rules to deregulate water suspension. They felt that there were no environmental issues with it. And the commission always has the opportunity to propose other new rules that the staff haven't thought about yet. What I'd like to do is review what the proposed regulations are that are out there right now. Under the proposed regulations, water spinach would remain a restricted species in Texas. Cultivation could occur by permitted growers only in approved facilities. It would allow for the possession for personal consumption. The regulations will provide specific requirements for culture, packaging, handling, disposal, and reporting so that this could be tracked. Businesses, wholesale, retail, markets, restaurants may possess and sell water spinach if they retain invoices from permitted growers within Texas and legal out-of-state sources. If these proposed permits or these proposed regulations were considered by the commission, the staff would have these follow-up inspection and monitoring requirements. Facilities would be inspected prior to the issuance of any permit. That's an absolute requirement. Law enforcement would increase their compliance inspection to make sure that both the grower and the people within commerce are complying with what the new regulations would say. Inland fisheries would continue with a directed vegetation survey in selected metropolitan areas, and we would do it at the time of year that we would think the maximum growth of that plant would be there. It would be late summertime when we would have the greatest opportunity of discovery. We will also be looking at our routine surveys. Our routine surveys, approximately 60 per year, will be due on our lakes. We will also be searching there for water spinach. And again, if water spinach were to be found in any one of these surveys, we would immediately eradicate it. We have the ability to do that. Then under the inspection and monitoring, it has been determined that we will do annual facility inspections to make sure that the facilities are complying with the rules as they have been adopted. We also would suggest that we report back to the commission within a year of time if you were to consider the adoption of these rules to give you a status of where we are in the process. The public comments that we've received have been strongly in support of the proposal. I believe I saw the letter from Representative Bowe that had been placed on the table for everyone this morning. We received a petition in August with 178 names on it to supplement these. The people that opposed the proposal, two of the four, we believe misunderstood the proposal. Their comments actually were written such that they supported the proposal. And then the other two have basically said that they believe that the commission should defer action on water spinach until the whitelist was developed in the department. So with that, those are my comments for you. My summary of our report to you.
Before getting questions, I just want to thank the work that you've done, and Ross and your staff, and really everybody involved, law enforcement, the agency. You know, this is important to a lot of people, and I think the department's handled it well. I thought the white paper was excellent. in scope and coverage, not only how it is today, but from our conception of history, and certainly helped me in a lot of ways. So I want to appreciate the time you've taken since before work. With that, open discussion. Commissioners, any questions, please?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to ask on your comment regarding the treatment of infestations of water spinach.
How is that done?
It would be an herbicide. It would be sprayed onto the plant. It would depend on how large an infestation is. Sometimes they can be mechanically removed. You can pull them up by the root if you were to do that. It was just if someone were to come in and find a plant and identify that plant, they would probably immediately just pull the plant. But if it were to take up some surface acreage, then we would come in with an approved herbicide and spray that plant.
Has it been done? Has that application been done? Okay.
We do vegetation spraying very, very often with infestations. Yes,
well, have you specifically treated an area for water spinach?
No, sir. We have never found water spinach in the wild. It has been found in the wild in Florida, and it has been treated in Florida and has been eliminated.
So that's where your data comes from as far as the chemicals release.
In terms of the success of the chemical that could be based on it.
Hopefully not like that. Any other questions, Commissioner Duggan?
You say that if the staff proposal is adopted, that we'll be inspecting the facility prior to issuance of a permit on an annual basis.
Yes.
Thereafter, we're going to have stepped up to law enforcement compliance inspections.
Yes.
And we're also going to have additional inspections by officials.
Additional surveys.
Surveys.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Well, there's obviously a substantial cost associated with that. So one of the comments that I made for Ross was that I think the permit fee needs to be revenue neutral to take into account the cost that the department can incur. Again, if the commission just proposes a comment I'd like to make and then ask you is that are we at a point where we know what we think the permit fee should be, the initial permit renewal?
Since it would be a new, not knowing what our universe will be, we do know at this point that we have 50 applications for permit under the current rule. Okay, we do know that. If we were to use that as our universe in terms of revenues that would come into the agency, we believe that we would be able to do the issuance of the permit and the monitoring within that. That is looking at and making some assumptions. Those assumptions are that the 50 permits that we have received right now are concentrated in that brochure area. The cost of an individual inspection, a person leaving an office and go doing the inspection and coming back to the office and then going to do it, doing that 50 times, the answer is no, we could not afford to do that. But we believe that there will be some great efficiencies in the congregation of these sites. If these are where all the penalties are, that there would be great efficiencies to us in that approach.
But we don't have any reason to believe that the permit applicants, the applicants, become just confusing.
No, sir.
Surely we're going to get to see the applicants in North Texas.
At this point, we know of no other commercial production. That is a shortcoming on our part. We know of no other commercial production. Our expectation is, yes, there are going to be some others. And our sites, our fishery sites that we do the inspections, we are scattered throughout the state. So those inspections could be relatively inexpensive for us to do.
Well, okay. On page 11, tab called white papers. We say that some supply was obtained from homegrown sources. And how do we plan to address the fact that we've got people out there growing now who are not expected, that are not compliant with proposed regulations? How do we propose to address those people and others who are likely to be the same? I'm told by Mr. Kipker, who quoted in his book, that that goes on in Florida. People who are growing that aren't applying for a permit, not applying for regulations.
I'll take my first shot at it, and then I'll ask Robert Goodrich to come on up. But in order for these, for the water spinach to be within the stream of commerce, they're going to have to have invoices from a permitted grower. And that is where that individual would have to get a permit now if he is going to sell. Robert, do you want to come on so that I don't mistake something?
I worked with the team quite extensively on the regulations. Gary Dry, the way it's worded in there and the way it's set up, we have a permit process, an invoice that attaches to that permit all the way through. It must be maintained for a 2-year period by the person who receives it. So we have a process in there to maintain the track, so to speak, where it's been from the retailer or wholesaler to maintain it from. So when we go into the market, we'll be able to verify that. There's other product on hand that's not documented, that in itself would be a violation. And then we would be able to track back to where that product came from. This whole thing was to regulate the process. You wouldn't be able to work without a permit. It's really what it boils down to.
Gary, I think you're saying that staff contemplates coming back each year to report on the status of this.
Yes.
For the foreseeable future.
Yeah, we're not going to codify that necessarily. We need to. That's what I've requested. So, and I've said a year seems to make sense because you know you kind of have that 12-month period of time. But or if anything dramatically changes one way or the other, gets worse, gets better, then we find funds or whatever happens. So that's been my request.
Another question I have is: we say that it grows prolifically at 77 degrees, but it will grow at below 77.
Yes, sir, my belief that it will grow at temperatures that are below 77 degrees. It just won't be very successful. It's a mean daily temperature. That it's more of a tropical temperature. And in Texas, we have no cities. We have no area in Texas that has a mean daily temperature of 77 degrees.
Do we know the temperature at which it dies now? That's freeze.
In the literature, it says this does not survive frost. And so I would assume that 32 degrees will kill it.
But if it were established in the wild, it would grow 50 degrees, it would die. Is that correct?
I do not know as well as I'm
And last question is Kelly Baker on this team? On your team?
No,
sir. Thank you.
Any other questions?
Please call us.
Okay, wonderful. If there's no other discussion, I will place this item on the Thursday Commission meeting agenda for public comment. Gary, thank you. Rob, thank you. Robert, thank you all. Appreciate you taking the time and effort. Now, I know more about water spinach than we ever thought we'd find out. It was an excellent patient. Well done. Mr. Smith, this committee has completed its business. Next, we move on.
on to Conservation Committee. Mr. Bivens, please.